Kilmeade, Kane, Hannity, Levin, and Lars. The truth is here. Freedom 970. The six pillars of freedom on Freedom 970, KUFO AM, Portland.
Investing Simplified is brought to you by Chuck Price, President and Wealth Manager of Price Financial Group, Wealth Management Incorporated, a registered investment advisor firm. Individual situations will vary, and the information on this show should only be relied upon when coordinated with individual advice. Other parties present on this broadcast are not affiliated with Price Financial Group Wealth Management. Chuck can be contacted by visiting www.pfgwm.com. You can email Chuck a question at askchuck@pfgwm.com, or you can call him right now at 503-417-7626. That's 503-417-7626. Now, here's the host of Investing Simplified, Chuck Price.
We do Investing Simplified.
Well, welcome to our live financial show here in Portland, Oregon. We got a nice day looking. looks like the clouds are going to get away, and we're going to have a nice day, I hope. And hopefully a nice Memorial Day weekend.
Looks and, like it to me.
Yep. And we do want to say right off the top here that Memorial Day is Monday. And it's a day when we honor all those that gave their life in the military and or had served in the military. And as a matter of fact, the holidays really kind of spread to honor anybody who's passed away. Originally, it was set up to honor those in the military, but it pretty much now honors about everybody who's passed away. But I do want to give special thanks to all those military families and people who have lost loved ones and who sacrificed their lives for our freedom. And I think it's a great thing that we at least honor them one day a year. That's for sure. Well, listen, with that, my name is Chuck Price. My voice just about went there, but I want to welcome Carl Jepson with the Warren Allen Law Firm.
Good morning and happy Memorial Day weekend.
That's right. And Kevin Stege with the Baker Colson CPA firm.
Good morning, gentlemen.
Even though he's wearing his Oregon Ducks shirt today.
There's nothing wrong with that.
Yeah. How do the Ducks look for football season?
Well, it should be an interesting year. Should be a good year.
Yeah. I think the Pac-12 is going to be really exciting this year.
Yeah.
I think it's going to be interesting to see how the Ducks do. This will be his second year, the coach.
I think so. Yep.
Yeah, second year, and I'll tell you, I've always liked to see the Ducks do well, but I have been rooting for Chip Kelly in the NFL because he's innovative, and I like that.
He's pretty fun to watch.
Yeah, he absolutely is. Well, listen, guys, I know there's been a lot of things going on in the marketplace. I'm kind of happy about the fact that we have the watchdog on Wall Street right before us now instead of that hyperactive mortgage guy. And I've never been one to believe that you should use your home as an investment vehicle. I think it's one of the stupidest things in the world to do. And anybody who did it in 2003 to 2006 knows exactly what I'm talking about if you're fortunate enough to still have your house, if you did that. It's not a good financial strategy. And this show, we want to talk about good, strong financial strategies, not ones that are not good. And with that in mind, last week we had a great week, Carl, or Kevin. Carl missed it. He was having a little relaxation, which is not all bad either. But we had Harry Dent on the show.
Sure did.
And Harry was very primed up.
Never short of opinions or perspective.
And I meant to send you a nice email I got from the people who are longtime listeners who listened to your answer and was very, very thankful for what you said about their situation.
Oh, that's right, regarding
the property.
Yes, yeah. That's right.
Yep. Yep. Yeah, the rental properties and then the development properties.
The sale, principal residence exclusion.
Yeah, and just for our listeners out there, if you do have a question or you do have a concern for whatever being is you don't have time to sit down with your CPA or your attorney or your financial guy, and you want to drop us drop me an email or drop Carl or Kevin, we'll be happy to answer it on the air for you. Of course, we won't say who you are or anything, but we'll answer your question if it comes in an email.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And you can, by the way, you can email me at chuck@pfgwm.com. And if you have a question, don't hesitate to send it to us. Well, I'm going to give a quick stock report. And then because the market's been kind of coming up. And here's the thing is, for those of you that listen to Harry Dent and Rodney Johnson on our show, they have consistently been saying that when the markets hit the all-time highs, that's when you want to be aware. That's when they've said they've tried not to narrow down to a specific time or a prediction, because it's pretty hard to predict what's going to happen in the future and predict when things could come up that could change the economics. And in this case, we now are reaching all-time highs in both the Dow and the S&P. And I think we need to be very, very mindful of that if you're an investor, particularly if you're a long-term investor. I think you've got to be very, very cautious right now, and you've got to have a strategy. And if you don't have a strategy, I think you're going to get caught short. So I would highly recommend you have a strategy. The Dow Jones closed at 16,606.27, and it was up 63.19, up 38 basis points. But now, where's the Dow since 10,907 when the market corrected? It was sitting at 14,164.53. Since that market collapse recovery, we were up 17.24% in 6 years and 7 months. That's a 2.62% per year return. That's not exciting. The Dow Jones closed at on 12/31/99 at 11,497. So in 13 years and 5 months, we're up 44.44%. That's 3.42% for the Dow Jones that prior to 2000, prior to that, the previous 80 years, averaged almost 10%. That's just about 35% of what the long-term average was. The S&P isn't much better. The S&P closed at 1,953. It was up again this week. And it's been steadily up, and it will continue as long as the Feds keep printing money they don't have. So where do we stand versus 10907 at 1565.15? In 6 years and 7 months, we're up 21.43, or 3.26% per year. Now, if we go back to 12/31/99, the S&P closed at 1469.25, so we're up 29.35, or in 13 years and 5 months, we're up 2.26%. The S&P, the previous 80 years, was over 10% net return. So that is a big, big difference. Oil closed at 104.39, and gold closed at 1,293. And I'm just going to make a comment here about crude oil. It is absolutely insane to me that we live in a country that has more oil reserves than Saudi Arabia, and we've got people stagnating our economy, stopping the production of oil. We haven't built a refinery in this country in 35 years. How dumb are we? How dumb are we to be dependent on other people when we could be totally independent of oil? And our oil prices, and I know everybody kind of laughed at this guy when he said it, when he was running for president, but the reality is if we had the federal government get the heck out of the way and we started printing, doing our own oil instead of printing money, if we started producing our own oil, we could have oil prices down in this country at probably about $2.50 a gallon. And do you think that would help the economy? Would that help people who don't have much money to get around to try to find a job? The thing we need in this country is we need jobs. When you're stopping 20,000 to 60,000 people from having a job in the oil industry, and then you cry and scream about, well, we need more money. Well, look, how about putting those people to work, having them pay taxes, and have them be productive in the country? That might not be too bad. And I understand all about, you know, all the environmentalists, and I'm just going to say this about the environmentalists. It's very interesting that after all the studies and all the crap we were told by the environmentalists that oil is bad, gasoline is bad, it's going to kill us, it's going to destroy the world. We need ethanol. We need to do ethanol. Ethanol's done two things, folks. Number one, it's three times more pollutant than gasoline. Now that the reports have come out, it's way more pollutant than gasoline, and it raises food prices. How smart are we as an economy? Listen, those idiots in Congress and the House and the President, all of them have been in office way too long. they have no idea what they're doing in the economy, and we need to get rid of all of them. And I mean, we do that at the voting poll. I'm not saying anything else. I'm saying do it at the voting poll. And, you know, when you get a chance to vote, vote and get rid of these people. Anybody who's been in office more than one term, I guarantee you they're not a regular person. They have no idea, and they probably are way wealthier than you will ever be. In fact, most politicians, I think Congress something has, the average guy has like $3.5 million in pension benefits. How many of you listeners out there have $3.5 million in pension benefits? How many of you out there have a $10 million estate? Not very many. I'm just telling you, that's what we've created. We've created royalty in these people, and we need to quit it. What we need to do is we need to ask you need to pick up the phone and call your senator and your congressman and say, hey, how about pledging your retirement and your salary to our Social Security benefits? Because I'm telling you what, there's a freight train coming, and most of the American citizens have no clue, but at some point, we have a way of passing the buck, and they call it kicking the can down the road. I'm telling you what, there's a day of reckoning coming, and it's coming soon, about 2017. There's not going to be enough money coming out of Social Security, into Social Security coming out, and they're not going to be able to print enough money to make those payments. So what are they going to do? We're going to reduce your Social Security check? No, I got a better idea. Why don't we just take all the assets that these guys have made in Congress and dump that into the pool and start paying some of that money back? And I always hear people say, well, there's not enough money. That's the problem, guys. There's not enough money. But let's make the people accountable for who did the wrong thing. You know, you always hear about throwing the baby out with the bathwater. This is crazy. We've got these people we keep sending back to Congress and the House, and they keep stealing your money. How smart are we? Not very when it comes to that. Well, I feel so much better now.
We feel better too, Chuck. You know, it's kind of have you seen the advertisement for Snickers where the guys, you know, the football player just goes crazy and they hand him a Snickers and all of a sudden he gets back and he's more down to earth. I think you needed that
well,
little thing.
I like the one with Robin Williams when he becomes he's the coach.
Yes.
And he becomes the Russian guy. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I thought that was the comrade. Yeah. I thought that was only Robin Williams could do that, but it was great. But I feel much better. Listen, if you got a question, you need to pick up the phone and give us a call. Hey, if you disagree with me, give me a call. I'd be more than happy to talk to you about it. Give me a call at 503-417-7626. That's 503-417-7626. And toll free, 800-990-0750. 800-990-0750. And by the way, if you want a copy of Harry Dent's new book, if you want to call in and you ask us a question today and you want a copy of the book, I will be happy to give you one if you want to come by my office and pick it up. Harry Dent is the co-author of a free newsletter, Survive and Prosper, and you can sign up for that at my website, or you can get it at Harry Dent's website at harrydent.com. I also have copies of the new book, The Demographic Cliff, How to Survive and Prosper in the Great Deflation of 2014 and 2019. In case you don't know, we are in 2014. So I would highly recommend you read that book. The only thing I would say to you is, make sure you have a bottle of aspirin because it's pretty blunt. And Harry's pretty blunt when you talk to him, but his writing is pretty blunt as well. Well, we're going to take a quick break and come back with Carl on the law and Carl's comments. So we'll be right back with Investing Simplified.
Price Financial Group Wealth Management.
The time to stop working is approaching, or maybe it's already arrived. CDs and money markets are paying only fractions of a point. How secure do you feel about retiring right now? Call Chuck Price. He's located right here in Portland, and he can show you how to increase your Social Security up to 67% using specific program rules and the file and suspend strategy. Chuck specializes in working with people who are either retired or are close to retiring, and he focuses on how to never run out of money during retirement. Do this today. Schedule a free 20-minute retirement plan phone consultation or schedule an appointment with Chuck himself. call 503-253-3000. That's 503-253-3000. Chuck Price at Price Financial Group Wealth Management. On the web at pfgwm.com. Got a legal question? Coming up is Carl Jepson, estate planning attorney and partner of the Warren Allen Law Firm, with Carl's comments. You can call Carl at 503-417-7626. That's 503-417-7626. Here's Carl Jepson.
All right, send lawyers, guns, and money.
Well, welcome back to Investing Simplified. This is Carl Jepson with the Warren Allen Law Firm, and I'm going to kind of bring back something that's a little bit confusing, and it's a very common situation that we face in the estate situations in my practice all the time. And in fact, I belong to what's called the listserv for the estate planning section of the Oregon State Bar, which is essentially a bulletin board online via email, and people basically air questions and share their opinions and comments amongst lawyers. And this is one of those topics that comes up quite often. And part of it has to do with, I think, just some misunderstandings, and some of it is just the nature of the complexity. But it's one of those things that clients find very, very frustrating. What we're going to be talking about is, how do you get into a safe deposit box if you don't happen to be a signer on that, or an owner, a lessee of the signer of the box? And this often comes up when someone, you know, dies. And so there's another thing that I want to add to it, and that is, there's also what we call a small estate, and that's a type of probate, a summary probate, if you will. And a summary probate or a small estate can be done if you have real property that does not exceed $200,000 and personal property that does not exceed $75,000 in value. So then you have this issue of the safe deposit box. And a lot of people put their important papers in a safe deposit box. So if you learn anything from this discussion, I would like you to know that it is important to have someone else that you really, really trust be the named lessee on your safe deposit box, so that if you die or pass away and someone needs to get into that box to find out what's in there, like your important papers, or maybe there are real valuable things in there, then it makes it a lot easier for them. If now, again, this is only if they're very trustworthy. If this is, you know, if this is your neighbor that says, "Hey, I want to buy your house when you die," you know, you don't want that guy down that one. But if it's, you know, if it's your trusted child or brother or sister or whoever it is that you look to be trustworthy, then they should have access to and know where that box is. That means they got to go to the bank and sign up with you. So anyway, and the reason I say that is because here's some of there's a lot more to it than just this, but this is just in the situation if you've got a small estate or you believe that there's a small estate. Say, for example, you're a surviving child and you were not on the safe deposit box, but you know that dad had a safe deposit box and you think that the safe deposit box has some stuff in it. You don't think it's you're pretty sure it's a small estate, what we talked about, $200,000 or $75,000. You're pretty sure that there's a will, but you think it's in the safe deposit box, but you really don't know. So here's what kind of the little bit of the process is like to figure all of those things out, and it's a little bit frustrating for most people. And banks have a hard time keeping it straight as well. And it's difficult because of the way that the several statutes, and it's much more complicated than it maybe should be, but this is the way they do it. So the first thing is, if you believe that you got to go and find that safe deposit box, the first thing you got to do is, before you can file a small estate affidavit, and a small estate affidavit is the document that establishes a small estate. That's another subject, but that's a fairly simple thing. But before you can even do that, before you can file that with the court, you must get an inventory of the safe deposit box. Now, the way you do that is, you have to prepare an affidavit, or someone has to prepare an affidavit that says you're the kind of person that should have access to this box. And that means basically a person who's named in a will as a personal representative, or a person who is a surviving spouse or an heir. There are several other categories, but those are the basic people. And then you have to have, and it basically says, you have to say, that you believe that there's papers in the box, or that you believe that there is, you know, personal property in the box that you should be able to look at. And then you also have to present a death certificate to the bank. So you got your affidavit, which, quite frankly, I think you're going to need a lawyer to have prepare. And then you need your death certificate. Then you go down. Then you go down to the bank, and if they are willing, which they usually are not, because they don't know what they're doing, they are then supposed to do an inventory. They're supposed to prepare an inventory of the box with you there, and give you a copy of that inventory, and give you a copy of the trust or will if it's in there. But I think, number one, the first stumbling block here is that every bank agent, every bank, you know, officer has different views of how this is supposed to be done. And so more often than not, if they don't really understand what they're doing, they're going to say no. So now you've got really a big hurdle. But nonetheless, let's assume that it works the way that it does, that they do it, and they give you your inventory, and yes, there's a will, and yes, you're the personal representative, and yes, it's a small estate because there's no more stuff in there than $75,000 worth of stuff. Now then, you can file your small estate affidavit, and then you have to wait 10 days, and then you have to go down back to the bank, and you say, give me the stuff. Well, that's fine, except that, you know, maybe you got, you know, bank officer number two, and he says, I don't care what bank officer number one said, I'm not going to do it. So there are procedures that you can make them do it eventually, but it involves filing a lawsuit against the bank. And so all I'm saying is it can be a real hassle. Don't blame the lawyer who prepared the small estate affidavit. Don't blame the lawyer who prepared the will, because this is just stuff that banks do and don't do. And like I said, on the listserv, this is a topic of great concern for many lawyers, because we do the best we can to make these things as simple as possible. And we find out later on that just through either ignorance or, you know, kind of resistance, the banks just don't want to comply with the law, even when, interestingly enough, the law actually says in some instances that they're not responsible if they have a bona fide, you know, if they rely on a bona fide affidavit or whatever, that they're not responsible for any loss. Well, so why should they be so recalcitrant to do it? I don't know. I think it's just that they're paranoid about doing something wrong. And maybe there's some, you know, reason for that. And in their defense, the way that this works is pretty darn complicated for what seems like a simple problem. So you know, you have to give them some slack, because it is complicated, and probably very few have a really good set of understanding of how this thing works. But anyway, so going back to my main point is, if you want to avoid all of that, either have a nice real safe in your house that's a fireproof safe that you can keep all your good stuff in, or B, make sure that someone that you really, really trust can have access to your safe deposit box when you die.
Well, I think the banks want to err on the side of safety, and because when they release assets when they shouldn't have, it's movie-like sensational sensationalism. So I think they're always looking to protect themselves in that regard.
Now, Carl, is the regulations for the small estate in Oregon, is that different than Washington?
Yes. Oh, quite a bit different. Oregon has allows you to do what amounts to a small estate with $200,000 in real property. That's the max you can have, and $75,000 in personal property, meaning, you know, cars, furniture, cash, jewelry, that stuff. Real property, of course, is land or houses or whatever. And so if you have value of less than those two numbers, $200,000 and $75,000, that's the threshold at which you can file a small estate affidavit. And that's the probate process, basically, is you file this affidavit. There are no other real court appearances required if it all goes smoothly. Washington is only deals with personal property. If you have real property, you can't do a small estate. Washington has $100,000 personal property, and also you don't even have to file. In fact, you can't file a small estate affidavit it's really interesting in court in Washington. You just prepare the affidavit, you sign it, and it's got some requirements
an affidavit of domicile?
Yeah, it's something like that. It basically says I'm the person that should get this stuff. And I mean, that's really what it is. And you go and you give it to the bank, and they're supposed to give it to you. And I'm thinking, I'll bet you that works really good too. I haven't had many of those, so it's not nearly as so you don't use it as often, because more often than not, small estates are used here in Oregon. You know, when there's maybe a combination of real property or personal property, but in any event, it's a little looser in Washington, and I know that banks are the same in Washington as they are here in Oregon. So I haven't had any clients do that much in Oregon. That we have done at least one small estate affidavit, but it was done under the auspices of a big trust, and we were able to work through the bank pretty well. But it can be a very challenging thing. And it's one of those things that some planning, a very simple planning aspect can make a big difference. And, it's frustrating for us lawyers, because we put these nice plans together with these nice documents, and then some 16-year-old, bank president says, I'm not going to do that. I don't care what you say the law says. I'm not going to do that. I even had a case on one occasion where the bank had, I think it was $25,000 in cash in a bank account, and that was basically the only asset. The decedent had a Medicaid, not a lien, but a Medicaid claim from the state of Oregon that needed to be paid. And we wanted to get the money so that we could pay the claim. And so we filed our small estate. We went to the bank, and the bank says, no, I won't give it to you. I'm only going to give it, we won't give it to you. We're only going to give it to the person named in the will. Well, there wasn't going to be any money going to that person, because the claim of the state came first. So we contacted the Medicaid people. And the state recovery people in the state of Oregon wrote a big letter, says, hey, dummy at the bank, this is what the law says. Send us the money. And the bank manager said, no, won't do it. So I sent a little letter to the bank that said, hey, I'm going to file a lawsuit in 10 days if I don't have the money, and I'm going to get my attorney's fees from you as well. And then I got my check. and I sent it to the, but I mean, it shouldn't be that way. I mean, it's like, how hard is this? So the complexity of all this stuff isn't always necessarily the fault of the lawyer.
So outside of the small estate affidavit, if, say, you have a large estate and you've got a safe deposit box, what's the normal route just to go, because you have to do an inventory? I mean, there could be a gold bars in that.
Oh, absolutely. And in fact, if you become a personal representative, if you've filed a probate and the personal representative is appointed, that person now has all the legal authority that the decedent has. So they have although I've had banks disagree with that too, but you then have the decedent goes down to the bank, presents them with what are called letters testamentary. That's the official paper appointing the person as the personal representative, and says, I'm the personal representative, give me the stuff. And they're supposed to get it. Mostly they do.
And you can get all those passports with fake names and gold bars.
Yeah. The Glock 17 and all
that
stuff. That's
Jason Bourne type.
All that stuff that nobody should know about.
Yeah.
Well, listen, we're going to take a quick break and come back with Kevin Stege, the tax investigator. But if you want to call, give us a call, 503-417-7626. That's 503-417-7626. Our toll-free 800-990-0750, 800-990-0750. We'll be right back with Investing Simplified.
When your legal rights and responsibilities are involved, you need attorneys you can trust. The attorneys at the Warren Allen Law Firm offer you solid legal advice and exceptional service. We practice in nearly all areas of law. We can help you with your legal needs, including wills, trusts, probate, contracts, real estate, construction, landlord rights, business, personal injury, divorce, bankruptcy, and civil litigation. The Warren Allen Law Firm has represented individuals and businesses for over 3 decades, and its 9 attorneys have more than 200 years of combined experience practicing law. By combining experience and knowledge with individualized attention and prompt service, Warren Allen is the law firm to rely on when you are in need of legal representation. We are conveniently located at 850 Northeast 122nd Avenue near the I-205 and I-84 interchange. I'm Carl Jepson, partner with the Warren Allen Law Firm, and I invite you to contact us at 503-255-8795 or on the web at warrenallen.com.
Do you have a tax question? Here's your opportunity to ask the tax investigator, Kevin Stege, CPA and partner of the Baker Colson CPA firm. You can call Kevin at 503-417-7626. That's 503-417-7626. Now here's the CPA with the tax answers, CPA Kevin Stege.
You are listening to Investing Simplified, Memorial Day weekend. Hope everyone has good vacation plans and has plans to spend time with family and remembering loved ones and especially our veterans. Definitely give us a call. We're your ace up your sleeve. If you've got a planning issue, if you've got something, a transaction you're mulling over, give us a call. We can help provide some insight, maybe a second opinion. We do span a wide area of expertise, I suppose we could say. But today on the Tax Investigator, we'll cover just a couple points of interest here. And then I've knocked on attorneys before in my segment, especially the attorneys in court cases. I love to bring those ones up. Yeah, Carl's giving me the look.
We know where you live.
That's right. And financial advisors, you know, Chuck, you've been pretty self-deprecating.
We do know where you live. Yeah.
But today we're going to knock on a CPA who
Hallelujah. Mm-hmm. We got a call there, Kevin.
I think we do.
We got a question from Peggy for Carl. Peggy, are you there?
Yes.
Good morning, Peggy. How are you?
I just wanted to clarify. After listening to what you'd said,
yes.
If you have a secondary person with signature on the bank box, does that not?
That's what I'm talking about. Yeah, that will take care of it so long as they're alive, and because then they are officially, technically, they're the owner of the box with you.
Okay. And another question: how do we get Chuck's book?
Pardon me?
How do I get a copy of Chuck's book?
Well, it'll be coming out shortly. It's just in the final legal process of it, and I'm hoping that very soon.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
And I'm ready for the tax guy.
Okay. Thank you, Peggy. Good question. Thank you.
Alrighty. Bye.
Thank you for that question. She must have a slow day if she's ready for the tax guy going. So hopefully your coffee's hot and it's strong. And
everybody loves taxes, Kevin.
Okay. Yeah. Yes, that's right. Well, this is interesting. I find, and I'll pose it to you gentlemen in a question. And I have a feeling Carl knows the answer because it's borderline law. But are IRS publications substantial authority to base your tax positions on? In other words, Pub 990, Pub 654. If there's a instruction in there that tells you what you can and cannot do regarding a particular transaction, is that substantial authority that stands up in court?
Well, it would seem like it would be because that's the law.
But I wouldn't be asking the question.
That's, I know, you wouldn't be asking the question.
Here's the problem. The IRS writes the publications, but they write the publication based on their interpretation of the law, which is found in the statutes, the Internal Revenue Code, which Congress writes, and then also in the IRS regulations, which they write. So, they have various opinions and things. And then there's case law and all other stuff. But ordinarily, you would feel that they were responsible for making the publication. And I would certainly argue that, even though I think if it push came to shove, if they made a mistake in their publication and they said, you know, yes, this is deductible, and it turns out that the law really is no, it's not deductible, then the law is going to trump the publication. But that's how I feel.
Yeah.
You're
spot on. This is a brief case, and actually this case actually provides us with a planning point, maybe a warning point for folks with IRAs. You know, there's a provision that says you can do unlimited number of trustee to trustee rollovers of your IRA to another IRA to get it in the spot that you want. That's not a problem. This is regarding what's called a non-trustee to trustee rollover, where you actually receive the funds. You have 60 days to put that back into another IRA. Well, this is a case where the IRS publication and even the proposed regulations, which carries, I think, a lot more weight than the publication, says that you can do applied on a IRA by IRA basis. It says you can do one, but only one per year on an IRA by IRA basis. But the actual law says you, as a taxpayer, get to do only one per year, and that's pretty significant. And it's kind of a cleanup measure where maybe you accidentally received it, you didn't mean to take your IRA out, or maybe you did and you had second thoughts. You can put it back in within 60 days. Well, this is the case where the pub and the reg says you can do it on an IRA by IRA basis, but the tax court nailed the taxpayer and said no, it's a per taxpayer per year rule. So that's a little bit of
this has been an ongoing battle for a long time on this case.
It has been,
and this is a landmark case. And mm-hmm. Ed Slott, as you know, I'm an Ed Slott advisor, and I go to his CPA school every year. Although it's basically for advisors on retirement planning, and mm-hmm. this has been a case they've talked about, for a long time, and it's been a long time battle. And it's good to have it finally clarified, though. Mm-hmm. It's good to finally say this is the way it's going to be.
There's a lot of gray area in terms of the unusual transaction or the what-if type scenario. And a lot of time, most of the time your transactions are pretty straightforward and you know what's going on and stuff, but it doesn't take much to take a transaction and put it out of the ordinary box and really need some interpretation.
Yeah, because there's real problems there. It's, and one of them kind of goes in that is the beneficiary IRA, because if you take the beneficiary IRA as a rollover check or take the check, mm-hmm. you cannot roll that over. It's a done deal. Once you get the check, it's a taxable event.
Yep.
So unlike in a 401k plan, you can take the check, and as long as you can deposit that money, as long as you roll it over within the 60 days, and you've done one a year,
yep.
you could do that and get away with it without paying a heavy tax penalty.
Yeah.
But you can't with the beneficiary IRA. So a lot of people they think an IRA is an IRA, but it's not.
That's right. Chuck, this is the exact type of scenario that maybe you are a beneficiary or somebody's passed away. Just run your situation and what you're planning on doing by somebody, Chuck, myself, Carl, who can take a quick look at the parameters surrounding, the rules around what you're planning on doing and make sure it works, and it can save you a lot of trouble and headache down the road.
Oh, absolutely. One of the most difficult situations that we ever face is when someone comes in and says, I did this transaction here, and I just wanted you to look at it. Well, usually if you've done it, it may be fine, hopefully, but it might not be fine, and usually you can't fix them. They're usually, like you said, if you've done it, your penalty's coming out.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
Well, we've got one that I called you on. I've got somebody who was referred to me, and I talked to this guy a year ago. His mother had passed away and left him her IRAs, okay? And he procrastinated to do anything and to change him over to a beneficiary IRA. And so we went a whole year. And the trust, this is the other thing I tell people, look, just because you have a bank trustee or you have a brokerage trustee, it is still your personal responsibility to do the RMD. Yeah, they're supposed to notify you. Yeah, they could. But the fact is, when the tax law comes, they're going to charge you. They're not going to charge the trustee. They're not going to charge the bank. And in this case, this guy procrastinated, and he comes to me after the fact. And I said, here's the problem you got. If you changed it to a beneficiary IRA, you had to take the taxable event out. You had to take a withdrawal. If you left it in your mother's name, there has to be an RMD taken because she's in her late 70s. So either way, you're going to have a tax penalty. So,
which is 50% of the amount that you should have taken out.
Plus taxes.
plus interest and penalty. The income taxes.
Yeah. And so I told him best case scenario is you got to plead to the IRS and send them a letter and try to ask for forgiveness and see if they'll just allow you to pay the taxes and waive the penalty.
Yep.
But believe me, not knowing the law is not an excuse for breaking the law.
That's right.
Sometimes the IRS will, and I've seen the IRS on a couple of clients we've had that came to us on situations like this. They, you know, when I talked to you about it, we sent letters, and the IRS said, okay, just pay the tax. But sometimes they don't.
That's right.
Yeah, and it's interesting because so many of these things which seem to most people to be sort of a common sense approach to things, they aren't. And it's not that these people are any less intelligent. They're just not as informed as some of us who realize that the government regulations often don't make any sense to us either, you know, but they're there. And so just because you think that something works the way it's supposed to, like safe deposit boxes, I mean, who would have thought that you'd have to do all that stuff to you know, get into one of those things? So it's, you know, it's just a good idea to try to, you know, get some advice before you do something or before you forget about doing something.
That's right. That's right. Well, moving on, we have a tax court case against a CPA. Yes, we will bring this one up.
I am shocked.
It is. And it's an interesting one. This is a scenario that, you know, maybe not just CPAs, but I think a lot of folks, maybe more aggressive taxpayers, have considered something along these lines where you try to take a personal interest and get the deduction or the expenses from that. This is a case of a CPA who had a tax practice. He filed a Schedule C, usually reported a profit, which was fine, but he also filed another Schedule C with his tax return, and that was he was also a professional gambler, and he bet on horse racing and a lot of it. And
He had two businesses.
Two businesses, which the losses from one, which I won't tell you which one that is.
Well, we can only guess.
Oh, yes. Yeah. netted against the profit from the other to report, ultimately, very little income each year.
This is the Seabiscuit LLC.
Exactly.
Probably the burnt biscuit in this case.
Exactly right. Yeah. So for a five-year period, he had gambling losses for four of those years, which he netted against his accounting income to show very little profit. And the IRS came in, kind of checked things out, said, nah, I think we're going to disallow the gambling losses. You get your losses up to the amount of your gambling winnings, but that's it. You don't get all the extras. And he was fairly creative in that his gambling winnings he put down as his gross sales. The cost of his bets were his cost of goods sold, so that gave us our gross profit, and then he took all these other administrative expenses, his travel, his meals and entertainment, you name it, to create a pretty nice loss. So the IRS came in and said, first off, you don't get to take those losses. But remember, gambling, you or me, anybody who would just do normal gambling, you have to report your winnings, but then you get losses only up to the extent of your winnings.
That's right.
And so that's specific for the gambling industry. And so, but this guy had some pretty pretty creative ways to try to get out of it. His argument to the tax court, which I won't go into all the details, but he was saying that he should be allowed to deduct some of the expenses that the bookie has. In other words, the bookie receives the whole pool of bets, and the bookie is entitled to 15% to 25% return to cover all of their costs and to make a profit. And he's entitled to his pro rata share of the bookie's expenses. And the tax court basically said, yeah, no. No, that's not going to work. And then he said that the fact that the gambling losses were limited to his winnings, that's unconstitutional because you're treating a business separate from other businesses. Well, you know, every business has its own regulations, and the IRS basically knocked that one down too. Here's the interesting part, which I find, is his argument that he should get a prorated share of the bookie's expenses, he didn't even report that on those tax returns. He just came up with that to argue something at trial. And so, anyway, he lost all the
that's
way around.
That's his excuse?
That's what happened.
My bookie told me it was okay.
Exactly.
Great.
Wow.
So that is the tax investigator for today. Be careful with your hobbies versus your business income. And if you're a professional gambler, you need professional help.
You know, that kind of reminds me of a few years ago. There was a guy that won the lottery, and he had kept track of all the tickets he bought, you know, like $100 a week for so many years, and tried to write that off as expense against his winnings.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it doesn't work.
Yeah, you only get your losses for that year against your winnings for that year.
Yep, absolutely.
So, yep.
Well, listen, you're listening to Investing Simplified. I almost said you're listening to the Tax Investigator, but you were.
That's
absolutely.
Right.
And listen, if you've got a question, give us a call. And the lines are open. We have a line open at 800-990-0750. That's toll-free, 800-990-0750. You're listening to Investing Simplified. We'll be right back with the Knowledge Trust.
Hello, this is Kevin Stege, shareholder with Baker & Colson Certified Public Accountants, serving the Portland and Southwest Washington areas for almost 40 years. We are a full-service accounting and consulting firm offering our services to a wide range of business and individual clients. One of the largest expenses to a household or a business is its tax burden. While off-the-shelf tax products can help file simple returns, they can't know your plans for the future and not only provide insight and planning to help you get there, but actually help you along the way. There are just some things that can't be replaced by experience. Whether you are just beginning your working career or have a well-established business with many employees, rely on the professionals at Baker & Colson to help in an efficient, accurate, and personalized manner. We're located at 2414 Northeast Division in Gresham and can be reached at our website at bakercolson.com or 503-666-5569. That's bakercolson.com, 503-666-5569. And remember, at Baker & Colson, our service is the product our clients remember most.
What you don't know can hurt you. Get that investing question or that legal question or even a tax question answered now. Call the Knowledge Trust at 503-417-7626. That's 503-417-7626. Now here's Chuck, Carl, and Kevin, the Knowledge Trust.
If I had $1 million.
Well, if you've got $1 million, you better pick up the phone and give us a call real quick and make some decisions on how you want to retain that $1 million in the future, and to make sure that you do it legally and under the tax laws and in a wise investment style. Wouldn't that kind of cover all three?
That's right. Avoid the gambling route with it.
Yeah. I definitely wouldn't follow the story we heard about the CPA in the previous segment. That was not good choices. Yeah. You know, Kevin, one of the things talking about the IRS that from time to time comes up, we get calls from people who get that letter from the IRS saying that you owe $30,000 in back taxes or you owe whatever. And that's a scary moment. So I just thought in asking you time, because we kind of ran out in your segment, I was going to ask you today, when somebody gets a letter like that, I mean, I always tell them, they call me, I don't know if Carl gets those calls, but I always tell them, listen, you need to talk to a CPA, because let's first of all find out what your situation is here, because otherwise we're just taking a wild guess. Hey, we got a quick question here. Sally's on the line. Sally, are you there?
Hi.
Hi, Sally. And you got a question about trusts?
Yes. When do you establish a trust for, when would you do that? And is there a specific circumstance or is there a dollar amount that needs for the value of an estate? And then also, do deeds need to be changed as well as auto registrations? And how does that affect for example, auto insurance, would you need to be list the trust as an additional insured?
Okay, yeah, that's a bunch of questions. Yes.
Sorry.
The answer to most of those were yes. Yeah. Basically, there's no specific time to establish a trust. It can be done any time, as long as the trustor, the person who creates the trust, is competent. You know, if you wait until you're, you know, not, and then you can't. But then the way that the trust works is you transfer assets into the trust. If it's real property, you transfer it via deed. If it's bank accounts and things, you go to the bank and they have forms that you transfer it into the name of the trust. Let's see, what was the other answer that you want?
Autos.
Pardon me?
Your autos, that would be the same thing.
I usually don't transfer automobiles because people tend to change them, but you can, you can put them in the trust. You got to go down to the DMV, and they charge, $100 to transfer the title to it. You can do that. And as far as insurance, it shouldn't make any difference to your insurance, because even though it's in the name of the trust, but I think what I would do is I would, if you do that, name them. You know, I always recommend to my folks that they contact their homeowner's insurance company if they transfer their asset into the trust, because, you know, even though it's a kind of a look-through type entity, it just makes sense that your insurance company would want to at least know. Contact the agent and find out if their company or your policy requires naming them as an additional insured. As a general rule, I don't think it is, but, you know, some insurance companies have different policies. So,
is there a dollar amount that, as far as establishing a trust in an estate?
No, not really.
Is worth $1 million or $2 million or?
No, the $1 million part of it has to do with Oregon's inheritance tax exemption amount. An individual can transfer up to $1 million tax-free, inheritance tax-free. Federal government allows you now $10.34 million. So most people aren't there. Obviously, if you have a very, very small estate, you may want to, well, it depends. Actually, it can be very economical when you think about it. The probate process can be substantially more expensive than most trusts. And so if you have a smaller estate, the cost to the estate is much greater if it's a smaller estate than it is if it's a large estate. But by the same token, you know, that may mean that you want to keep more of your money in your pocket and subtract the cost of administration from, you know, your heirs. It's just kind of a personal preference, I think. Many of my clients feel that they want to create a trust because they really want to spare their heirs, usually their children, from the complexity and time and frustration, if you will, of going through a probate process, which takes some time. It's at least 6 months in general, and it involves some expense. There's a lot of paper trail that the lawyer has to put together to get it through there, and it does have some significant expense that goes with it. And the trust really shortens that up quite a bit, and also minimizes it. There still may be some cost depending on the nature of the trust, but a lot of times people who are husband and wife, say, for example, and they own all of their property as a husband and wife and as joint tenants with right of survivorship, they may not really need a trust except in the situation where they're going to be, you know, killed at the same time. But if one of them dies, everything automatically goes to the surviving spouse. But there again, that depends on whether or not they have their assets separate or are they jointly held. So, you know, there's no real... There are various reasons why you might want to have a trust established. I think, any time that you have substantial assets, it might be useful to look at, because it also provides some mechanism for managing those assets in the event that you become incapacitated. So you know, it's an individual thing, but...
You know, Sally, I think what you're kind of maybe looking for is that one of the things that we recommend to our clients, if they have some assets... is one of the great things a trust does is afford you the privacy. It's not public information. If you go through probate, it is all public information. People can, you know, there's a lot of bad people out there that look just to scam people when they inherit a lot of money or they have some assets. So to me, a living trust, from my point of view, not being an attorney, but from my point of view from planning and working with my clients, is I like them to have a trust because they got the privacy. Nobody knows their situation. And from a standpoint of settling the estate from an investment side, if the client has a trust, we can usually settle the estate in a couple of days. I mean, once we have the death certificate, we can pretty much do it because they don't have to go through that 90 days to 6 months probate stuff. And so from a planning standpoint, I look at it different than Carl's got to look at the legal side. I get to look at the fund side. And to me, the investment side of it is it's quick, it's easy, it goes directly to the heirs you want it to go to, and nobody knows about it.
One last thought here while we have about 2 minutes left. You did ask about the tax savings. If there is a husband and wife situation and you have assets over $1 million, probably closer to $1.5 million or $2 million, then the AB trust scenario or what's called the credit shelter trust, there could be a tax savings there with the Oregon estate tax if you want to use that. But there's other methods around that too. But that's a possibility.
Yeah, absolutely. That's pretty much a common way of doing it. Really, is to split the assets of the husband and wife at the death of the first spouse.
Thank you.
Okay. Thanks, Sally. Good questions. Very good. Yeah, that's always a thing, Carl. You know, people that we talk to all the time, they you know, depending on the amount of assets they got, they wonder, should they do a trust? Should they do a will? But here's the biggest thing I'm going to say. Do something. Don't have your estate where you don't have a will. Or don't have your estate where you don't have a trust, where you don't have some things laid out of how you want things to go. Because I guarantee you, if you don't, they won't. It's that simple.
Yeah, they'll go somehow, but it may not at all be what you want.
No, it'd be determined by some probate judge.
Yep. And it's the rules of intestate succession are not always exactly the same thing that you might want for yourself.
Yeah, and the other reason I kind of mentioned it, Sally, and you kind of got into it a little bit, Carl. But one of the great things about setting a living trust is you don't always have to do things equally.
No,
you know have people. You can instruct them to do things like their stretch IRA. You can do things like making sure that. The kids don't have access to the money immediately if you want to. There's a lot of planning things you can do. But, gosh, if you're out there and you're listening to us and you don't have a will or you don't have a trust, there's no time like next week to pick up the phone and call your local attorney and get one. So you're listening to Investing Simplified. We'll be back. We actually got a little bit of time here, but we're going to be on next Saturday. So hope you all have a great Memorial Day. And don't forget those loved ones that have passed away, particularly the ones in the military. That is a weekend that we get to honor them. So thank you all very much for listening, and we'll talk to you in a week. Thank you very much.
Price Financial Group. Wealth.